Disrespect welcomes Orfeo Buxton. He is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and a neuroscientist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He has helped us find his paper on adverse metabolic consequences with circadian disruption. We're going to talk about it, and then we're going to talk about the socioeconomic implications for certain work groups of this study. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Where to start? Sleepy people.
Sure. Well, there was just some information out from the CDC in the last day or two showing that 30% of Americans are getting less than 6 hours of sleep.
Wow.
The concept that sleep is one of the three pillars of health, along with diet and exercise, is gaining considerable currency. For our study of circadian disruption, we were motivated by studies of sleep restriction alone that showed that not getting enough sleep increases diabetes risk, along with other health complications.
Yeah, it seems to be a broad swath. Was the focus of your study diabetes?
The focus of our study was the metabolic mechanisms by which circadian disruption, meaning your 24-hour circadian rhythms not being in alignment with the light and dark cycle and meal cycle, how could that lead to increased metabolic consequences?
I know you're a doctor in sleep medicine, a PhD. What drew you to the duality of health consequences and circadian disruption for this study?
Well, there's plenty of information that night workers and shift workers have increased risk of obesity and diabetes.
Okay.
But in those population level or epidemiology studies, there's a tendency to interpret those results as being the night workers' fault. So they have bad diet, they have poor health behaviors, that there's something wrong with the worker. That's why there's so much diabetes and obesity.
I see.
What we sought to do was, in very carefully controlled conditions, so controlling for diet especially, do we see in normal healthy individuals metabolic consequences of circadian disruption?
Uh-huh.
So this study was a controlled laboratory study that could tackle a more mechanistic question that those population studies can't.
And the study concluded successfully from your point of view. You did establish this relationship.
Right. We saw that even normal healthy volunteers carefully screened to have no medical problems and so forth, that when we challenged their metabolism with just a standard meal, a breakfast, we saw that when they had circadian disruption combined with sleep restriction for 3 weeks, that in response to the meal, their glucose levels went very high after the meal and then stayed higher for several hours compared to when they were rested and sleeping at a normal time.
Now, that's what you call a postprandial hyperglycemia.
Yes, that would be the technical term for it.
Okay. Further on in your paper, you make note of circadian disruption and its relationship to other more discreetly identified factors, rhythms of glucose, insulin, cortisol, which follows from that insulin problem, and 24-hour profiles of leptin and free ghrelin, which I'm not sure my listeners know, and I would probably have to go back and figure out what it is, too. Body weight, diet, activity, body temperature, it doesn't seem to leave much untouched.
Well, we wanted to look at the full energy balance equation. So as every dieter must know, what you take in and how you use that fuel and then how you process that fuel all matter. So if you want to lose weight, you have to eat less. If you want to keep that weight off, you have to burn more calories while continuing to eat less. So we were measuring all of those components of the energy balance equation.
Oh, okay.
I feel I should mention why those glucose levels went higher, because that's really the interesting mechanism that we've identified in this study.
Good.
The insulin levels in response to that standard meal were much lower with circadian disruption than when the subjects were rested and sleeping in at a normal circadian time.
Oh, really?
That was a surprising finding. It's a very large effect, a large reduction. The pancreas just doesn't work as well. It's like the pancreas is jet-lagged too.
Okay.
And so we really needed to understand why that was. And so the other measurements that we made were really looking for reasons why and how fast that insulin change occurred.
Yeah. 24-hour profiles of leptin and free ghrelin.
Sure.
I've heard the terms before, but it's not something not in my daily vocabulary. What are leptin and ghrelin?
Well, those are two hormones secreted by peripheral tissues to communicate with the brain. Leptin and ghrelin are have been called the yin and yang of hunger and satiety.
Okay.
And they have, the higher the levels, the opposite effect. So here's how I remember them. When your stomach is growling, because you're hungry, it's secreting ghrelin.
Okay.
So ghrelin goes up just before a meal and makes you more hungry, makes you crave food, makes, you know, the smell of cooked food can elicit ghrelin. And then after you eat, those go down. So ghrelin drives hunger, the stomach communicating to centers in the brain to eat and to crave food. Leptin is secreted by fat cells. It's an adipokine, which simply means fat message.
Okay.
And it's a signal from our fat cells to our brain. And high levels mean those fat cells are happy. There's plenty of fuel around. And when those levels drop, starting 5 or 6 hours after we've last eaten, usually, then that signals a lack of satiety and that it will make you hungrier. So high ghrelin, hungry, low leptin, hungry.
I see. Okay.
These were of interest because previous studies have shown that when you modify sleep, you can change your leptin and ghrelin levels. With sleep restriction and maybe not quite getting enough calories, your ghrelin levels go very high and your leptin levels go very low. You get very hungry. You crave food. You crave less healthful foods. And you eat more, given the opportunity. If you control diet, ghrelin goes high and leptin goes low and you're hungry. But if you allow people to eat more food, their leptin levels and ghrelin levels don't change if they get a chance to eat a couple hundred more calories a day.
Okay.
So it sort of promotes, sleep restriction promotes excess snacking in a way that causes weight gain on the order of a few weeks.
Okay.
And it changes the preference of your food for less healthful food when you're sleep restricted. We've seen that in the field too. So people such as in this trucker study we did, if your sleep is inadequate, it causes you to eat less healthfully.
Yeah, I can believe that. Is there an effect if you, now you say leptin is linked to fat cells, if you're already have a borderline BMI or you're obese, does this profile get more exaggerated or what?
Sure. Leptin levels are highly related to how the volume or mass of fat that you have.
Okay.
So the more fat, the more leptin, and values can range from, you know, 3 to 30 across people, and it's proportional to their BMI, body mass index, the amount of fat they have.
And just for our interest, which is the flag, the lower number or the higher number?
For leptin?
Yeah.
Well, within a person, if their leptin levels go down, they're hungrier. And if their leptin levels go up, they're not hungry, or their fat cells aren't hungry, aren't driving them to be hungry. But the more fat you have in your body, the greater the amount of leptin secreted.
Okay.
So within an individual, it's the change in leptin that is the signal. Across individuals, the amount of leptin is directly proportional to fat.
Okay.
So some of those other 24-hour circadian rhythms, we saw a circadian rhythm in cortisol, which we expected. And what we saw was that the cortisol levels were higher right away. So in the first week of the study, cortisol levels were higher. And by week 3, those levels were still high, but not yet higher still. So that cortisol increase is one of the most consistent effects of sleep restriction and now circadian disruption.
Is it fair to call that the stress hormone?
It is a stress hormone, but at these levels, we don't think of it as a stress level, more of a mobilizing fuel level. So you need cortisol to, you know, have energy and be active. It helps to mobilize fuel.
All right.
And it seems that seems to be increased in subjects who are sleep restricted, as if the body is interpreting fatigue as hunger and a need to mobilize fuel to respond to whatever challenge is causing that sleep loss in the first place. So it's, that could be an adaptive response.
Yeah, maybe even a need to be ready for things you haven't seen because you're fatigued and sleepy. That would be an evolutionary response.
Quite possibly. So we also saw that glucose, even fasted glucoses each morning that we took them, with subjects were fasted, their glucose levels were higher, and that was the case at all circadian times of day, and in the first week and in the third week of this exposure to prior circadian disruption and sleep restriction. So the glucose response happens seemingly right away. The insulin response, however, was not present in the first week.
Okay.
It only appeared, and insulin levels lower, in the third week.
Okay.
So it seems that we have identified a potentially dynamic time course.
Okay.
We didn't collect any data in week two. So sometime between 2 weeks and 3 weeks of this circadian disruption cycle, the pancreas stops responding adequately and glucose levels go higher.
Okay. Now, if glucose levels go higher, increased glucose in the bloodstream could also support other organisms too, couldn't it? Fungi and things like that.
It could. I don't know a lot about that.
No. Well, I'm not sure that anybody does, but I've been having problems with that kind of thing, and it puts up a flag for me. If your glucose levels goes up and you have problems with, like, yeast and fungi, the potential for problems with that is going to go up, too.
Usually we think of higher glucose levels as promoting hypertension, higher blood pressure, to have more of that sugar. In that case, at higher levels, acts like a salt. So there's more stuff in your blood, which pulls more water into the bloodstream inside the blood vessels, increasing blood pressure. That's one of the reasons there are many problems with diabetes is due to that hypertension.
Okay. And the final topic listed for the study, before you go into the conclusion or discussion, body weight, diet, activity, body temperature. What happens to them?
Well, we wanted to make sure that we wanted to determine whether the change in insulin was due to any other changes in the energy balance equation. So we looked at changes in body weight, the amount of calories they actually ate, and body temperature and activity. What we saw was that they lost a small amount of weight across the study because we controlled their food very tightly.
Okay.
They actually had the same amount of food. We weigh their food each meal when it comes back. They had the same amount of food at the rested part of the study as the circadian disrupted, sleep-restricted part of the study.
All right.
Their body temperature went down slightly, a tenth of a degree, and none of these factors explained the insulin decline. And they had slightly more wrist activity, but they weren't allowed to do exercise. That was just reflecting that they were awake more and more hours of the day. So none of those energy balance considerations really explained statistically or otherwise the reduction in insulin. We did notice one major effect, which was a reduction in resting metabolic rate.
Yeah.
So if resting metabolic rate went down to this at this level without a change in diet or exercise, that would lead to on the order of 10 pounds a year of weight gain. So if we extrapolate this size of an effect for a year, it would lead to a weight gain of 10 pounds. That's an extrapolation, but has serious implications of circadian disruption for obesity, as is seen in night workers.
Yeah, over 30 years, that's 300 pounds. I don't want to dwell on it, but it strikes me if you were already diabetic that all the effects noted in this study would be exaggerated. These were healthy people, right?
Right. Well, there are other studies showing that diabetics are much more likely to have sleep disordered breathing, mm-hmm. and the severity of sleep disordered breathing or the cessation of breathing during sleep is related to the severity of diabetes. But we haven't done studies in diabetics to see if they have even worse effects of circadian disruption.
All right.
And now we'll take a short break. Craig McCarron, Hearts Finn Lion.
Don't be naming any names when your heart goes up in flames. This old love affair ain't going anywhere. My heart's been lying, it's true, and you've been trying to you just say the word you wanna hear. I've been down that street so many times before, but you won't hear me knocking at your door. She's out there somewhere, someone else tonight, a neon sign burning
study by Karen Ertl that actually fleshes out a socioeconomic meaning of what you found. This is status, occupational characteristics, and sleep duration in African Caribbean immigrants and U.S. white healthcare workers.
Yes, I was the senior author on that paper. We looked at a nursing home, low-wage, high-stress kind of a job, and these were primarily women. And this was an occupational sample, so there were several hundred women in the study. And we noted, as has been seen elsewhere, that there was an ethno-racial difference in sleep duration when we measure that sleep for a week using what's called wrist actigraphy, or a device like a wristwatch that measures wrist movements and from which we can infer the average sleep duration for that week. What we saw was that blacks sleep a mean and median of 1 hour less than their white workers in the same facilities. And we expected that we hypothesized that occupational characteristics would explain that apparent ethno-racial difference. other studies that had looked at this didn't have the richness of work characteristics that we had in this particular study for the Work, Family, and Health Network.
What we observed
was that there were many disparities in the workplace.
Yeah.
So blacks and Hispanics in this population had lower paying jobs, lower status jobs, more strain from their jobs, meaning high demands and a low level of control in the job.
Right.
So those are somewhat common in low wage, high pressure industries. But surprisingly, those disparities did not explain the differences in sleep. What
Wow.
did explain the differences in sleep were that the blacks work slightly longer work hours per
Mm-hmm.
week.
Yeah.
There were more more workers in the 60 to 70 hour category than whites, who had more workers in the 20 something hour category per week. And that had a small effect. The largest single effect, though, was due to night work.
Mm-hmm.
So African Caribbean migrants, blacks, who and women who worked the night shift were far more likely to have a short sleep duration.
All right.
Because of that night work. And so if we think about diabetes for a moment, diabetes is much more common in African Americans. And
yeah.
selection to night work may be part of that increased risk. And so we just like to keep in mind that when there are disparities in some health characteristics, like the amount of sleep that you can get or selection to night work, that those can represent real risks to chronic disease, for chronic disease, and can in part explain what look like ethno-racial differences when they're really workplace differences.
Yeah, that's quite indicative of a rationale, I would say, for differential access to healthcare for racial communities. And I can't see Americans endorsing that. I can't even see Canadians endorsing that.
Well, there's a lot of controversy around healthcare, but and there's also some matters before Congress now to eliminate large portions of the safety net for Americans in poverty. So I'm keeping an eye on these types of developments that would, we expect, exacerbate existing health disparities that are already widespread.
Some interesting statements in the introduction that weren't clear to me. Caribbean Americans reported fewer sleep complaints compared to U.S.-born African Americans, and immigrant European Americans reported more sleep complaints than U.S.-born European Americans. What's the difference going on here?
Well, I'm not sure that I can exactly explain the European immigrants, but what we generally find in studies of immigrants from, say, Mexico or the Caribbean or Asia, is that immigrants generally arrive to the Americas, I'm referring to the U.S. here,
yeah.
Arrive in the U.S. with healthier lifestyles, better diet, and completely different social constructs around health behaviors, and that over the subsequent generation or two, those benefits of that immigrant culture fade. And so if we want to think of the toxic American lifestyle, immigrants generally don't arrive with it, but eventually obtain it, especially if they remain of low socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
They take on the...
high fat, high salt, high stress.
High fat, high salt, unhealthful diet, maybe a little disrespect for sleep and exercise,
right.
And too much television.
Yeah, too much. I never thought of that. No, it's not a factor in my life, but I've seen it at work. Okay. Was there something that you wanted to say to conclude your comment on these two studies, which are pretty dramatic?
Well, I don't like to, stay gloom and doom, you know, don't sleep or be circadian disrupted and you're going to die early. And we are trying to focus our current efforts on positive interventions to help remedy some of these problems. So, for example, my primary research the last several years has been on the Work, Family, and Health Network, where we are attempting a workplace intervention in nearly 3,000 adults at 60 different work sites to improve the social environment at work, particularly managers and the teams that report to them, in hopes of improving the cardiometabolic risk and sleep of their employees and their families.
Social environment sounds like
discrimination. Reducing work-family conflict and so forth.
Oh, okay.
So I'm hoping to address some of these problems which have a social root, but a real biological mechanism, a measurable biological mechanism by which these social factors and disruptions of sleep get under the skin and cause chronic disease risk in a modifiable and fixable way for some.
So this spills over into the home and relationships and causes more stress and pushes all these factors up further if it's not observed.
Right. Yes, and to the children in the household. I mean, it's very many adults with small children at home may be willing to sacrifice for their children, but if they thought that they were bringing these negative effects home to their children and simply passing them along, they would be less willing to make those sacrifices.
If somebody wanted to be more aware of the influence in their own life of these effects, whether it's because they're poor or they're black or an immigrant, and they don't have access to your study or your interventions in Boston, what would you recommend they do?
Well, we have some proposals in to improve community worker education and skills around sleep habits and sleep health in low-wage and urban settings. And we're hopeful that if that is funded, we would be able to reach out with the information we've gleaned in either workplace settings or expensive inpatient clinical trials, and to really take that information out to the broader community. So we do see that sleep health is an area that's woefully under-addressed in the primary care and community health settings, and we're endeavoring to do something about that.
Great. My own observation, would it be fair to say that if you're offered a promotion with more responsibility and not a lot more perceived benefit from your point of view, that it might already, would it be fair to say that from my point of view that, yeah, this is going to be hard. From my point of view, it looks like it might be fair to say if you're offered a lot more responsibility and a promotion without an equal measure of perceived benefit, that it might be wise to contest that promotion or even turn it down. What do you think?
That's maybe something for those select few who have an option. If you can walk away from your job or have something else lined up, that sounds fine. But since the economic collapse, I would say that there's a lot more strain of not having a job, and that as long as corporations are taking the lion's share of the profit margin of most businesses, and instead real wages for most people in developed countries are in a long-term period of decline, that it's probably better to have a job than to not.
Right. So take your lumps in the short term, make good in when times improve. I think employers are expecting.
I would add
this.
That you know, it's a lifestyle choice to need to stay where you are. It's possible to also live considerably more simply, and that's the other part of that that balance, that work-life balance, is also reducing consumption.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I get your point, though, that, you know, endangering your job when jobs are scarce is not an option that many people can entertain.
But that's right.
But the changing your lifestyle is one that they can.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the time that you spent with me today in dealing with the equipment issues that we've had and getting this down for a listener. Thank you very much for coming on the air with me today, Orfeo.
It's been my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks. Bye now.
Bye.
And now, Craig McCarron. Appropriately, thanks, just the same.
You can sit by the door with your head in your hands, talk about things that I don't understand. I quit playing that game, thanks just the same. So you wanna play hardball with sweet love and emotion, break the same rules that you make. I quit playing that game, thanks just the same. Don't try and put me in a corner, turn my head around, hang me out to dry, cause I'll leave without a sound. Think about the way love just passed us by. I quit playing that game, thanks just the same. I quit playing that game, thanks just the same. Thanks just the same.
Now, in 2012, it's fun to listen to this interview from the past of the podcast from Australian Broadcasting Corporation, medical broadcaster Norman Swan.
Diane Lauderdale, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Health Studies at the University of Chicago, was one of the people involved in a recently reported study.
We undertook a study to measure sleep in a cohort of community-dwelling persons that had been followed for 15 years for the development of coronary artery risk factors and disease. And we added an objective sleep measurement for about 700 members of the cohort.
And why did you seek to look at sleep?
There have been a number of recent studies that were done in sleep laboratories where sleep was manipulated and people who were not allowed to sleep for very many hours had short-term effects that were surprising and large. For example, their glucose metabolism was worse after a few nights of only being allowed to sleep 4 hours a night, so it looked like they might be on the road to getting diabetes. And hormones that regulated hunger, leptin and ghrelin, their daily 24-hour cycle was altered in a way that made people feel hungrier than they would otherwise. And then other studies have found cognitive effects, that people couldn't learn things and remember things that they had heard the day before if they hadn't slept well. And then on the other hand, there'd been some big studies where information had been collected from people about how long they usually slept, just by asking them, how much sleep do you usually get at night? And associations were found between those self-reported sleep hours and risk of mortality, risk of being obese.
And that's quite important, that sort of finding, because when you talk to sleep specialists, they say there's a lot of difference between common or garden insomnia and the artificial laboratory situation where you don't allow people to sleep, because people who are insomniac often perform quite well, and they don't get into a lot of strife. So it's important to see whether or not what happens in the lab happens in real life.
Right. There were two reasons to undertake a different kind of study. One was that maybe the people who are sleep restricted in the laboratory, there's no knowing whether that would actually play out over time, or whether the situation that if people can keep themselves from sleeping as long, either because they don't want to take the time to sleep, or because they just can't get the sleep, whether it has the same results as being systematically awakened when you're deep asleep in the laboratory. So there was that. And then on the other hand, these studies that had found the associations between self-reported sleep hours and serious health outcomes, there are questions about whether people actually have a very good grasp of how much they sleep. And so it may be when you ask somebody, how much do you usually sleep, the information you're getting says something about how much they sleep, but it says also something about how they feel about their sleep and how they feel about whether they're able to realize the schedule they want, accomplish what they want. There might be some extra information that's influencing how they answer it, so it might not be completely accurate. So we wanted to do a study where we measured sleep without disrupting it.
So what did you do?
We gave people a little wrist device called an actigraph, which is like a very sensitive pedometer that measures movement in all directions, and it gives a very good estimate of when they were actually asleep.
What were you looking for?
Our original interest was actually in looking at whether measured sleep influenced people's change in their weight. And many studies have found that if you measure sleep or ask people about sleep and measure their weight at the same time, there is a correlation that people who weigh more sleep less. And so the hypothesis, though, had come about that maybe people sleeping less and less was actually one of the factors driving the obesity epidemic. In this case, it's completely reasonable to think that the causal direction could be either which way, though. And so
if you're overweight, you could be snoring and having sleep apnea or something like that.
Or just generally not able to sleep as well.
So what did you find?
For that piece, for the body mass index, we found that we did have a cross-sectional association. So the measured sleep and BMI at the same time were correlated, but that there was absolutely no effect of sleep duration on change in BMI over 5 years.
That means fat people didn't sleep as well. But looking at the cause and effect the other way around, if it was cause and effect, there was no evidence from this study that sleeping badly makes you more likely to put on weight. As Dan Lauderdale said earlier, this long-term follow-up study was really into heart disease. So they chose something called coronary artery calcification found on a CT scan as a marker for arterial damage, and then compared the amount of artery calcium to sleep patterns.
We had two CT scans where the calcification was measured 5 years apart, and then between those we measured sleep twice. And we took the people who did not have any evidence of calcification at the baseline CT exam, and then we looked at whether their average measured sleep predicted their having first evidence of calcification 5 years later. And there was an association, and we were very surprised at how strong it was. I should say, first of all, that the actual measured sleep duration in our cohort was less than maybe what people expect. So it was an urban population in their 40s, and the average was only 6 hours, although people generally thought they were getting closer to 7 hours of sleep. A significant number were sleeping less than 5 hours, and only a handful, like, you know, six people actually measured at 8 hours or more of sleep a night. So we don't know whether this is an unusual population or this is actually how 40-year-olds all over the U.S. sleep, and we don't know whether it's how people have always slept or whether this indeed is less than people used to sleep. But in any event, it was surprising. So what we found is that the people who slept less than 5 hours a night, about 27% of them developed calcification over the course of 5 years. The people who were in the middle, who slept 5 to 7 hours, about 11% developed calcification. And the people who were sleeping 7 hours or more, only 6% developed calcification. And then through statistical methods, we tried to make sure that we weren't seeing that association just because of correlations with other factors.
Such as smoking, overweight, things like that.
Yes. We took into account all those things, and there was still a very strong association between the measured sleep duration and the calcification.
But of course, associations don't tell you whether sleep's just a marker for something else and has nothing whatsoever to do with coronary calcification.
You're quite right. It could be some other factor because we understand so little about what influences how much people sleep. And clearly there are social conditions, economic conditions, household conditions, as well as psychological ones and health ones. We just have started to investigate this. So there could be some factor or factors that influence how much people sleep that also influence separately the risk of coronary artery disease.
And were their coronary risk factors higher as well in relation to their sleep, so their cholesterol level, their blood pressure, and so on?
Some of them were and some were not. Blood pressure was related to sleep. Fewer of the cardiovascular factors than we might expect were related to sleep.
And what predicted whether or not you were a person who slept 7 hours versus under five?
Women slept longer than men, and that's been found in lots of studies. Women just seem to need more sleep than men. We only had about a 12-year age span, and so age wasn't related, although if you have a bigger age range, you do find an association. People with more education and with higher income did not devote more time to trying to sleep, but they were more successful at sleeping during that time. So they ended up getting more sleep than people with less education and lower income. People who smoked got less sleep, which is consistent with nicotine being a stimulant. People who drank more alcohol spent more time in bed but did not get more sleep. Physical activity was not related.
But since the study did not prove cause and effect, it can't be assumed that getting more sleep is good for your arteries. Well, at least that's my excuse for not getting more kip. Associate Professor Diane Lauderdale is in the Department of Health Studies at the University of Chicago.
And now, Flatland 6. Craig McCarron, Broken in Two.
There's a storm out in the rain, going insane. Found your love, bring me above. I'm broken in two without you. Well, you walked out my door and left me here on the floor. I can't cry no more. Well, I'm paralyzed, like a tears in my eyes. I'm broken in two without you. What did I do? Hurt you? What can I do? Bring you back.
Thank you.
High blood pressure, the jargon name for it is hypertension, is the single most important biological risk factor for premature death in Australia. It can start early in life and eventually may cause heart attacks, strokes and heart failure, meaning the heart muscle is knackered and can't pump blood around the body. So keeping your blood pressure down and lowering it if it's raised is important for a longer, healthier life. Things like exercise, weight loss and reducing alcohol intake all work, but in some people they aren't enough, so medications are needed. But there are people who, despite swallowing everything modern medicine has to offer, still have dangerously high blood pressure. It's called refractory. But there may be good news. A group at Monash Medical School in Melbourne, led by Professor Henry Crum, have piloted a surgical technique performed through a catheter threaded up from the thigh, which cuts or damages nerves linked to blood pressure control. They're called sympathetic nerves, and attacking them surgically isn't a new idea.
That is correct. In the 40s and 50s, there was a movement to surgically denervate, which was really quite major surgery, which did actually lower blood pressure, but it left patients with major problems. They couldn't stand up without fainting. They had impotence, other problems. So really, it's been a target for years, but this new approach is one that has, as we showed, major effects on blood pressure, but without major adverse effects.
When you say denervation, you're talking about cutting nerves. Just give us a bit of the background to what's going on in the body here that gives a rationale for the old surgery and indeed this new surgery.
Sure. Well, the target is the renal sympathetic nerves. These are nerves controlled by the brain, but running in the kidney, adjacent, in fact, to the main renal artery, and that's really the anatomical relationship that's being exploited by this new approach.
So this is the artery that provides oxygenated blood to the kidneys?
Correct. And it's also, importantly, accessible through the access to the femoral artery to reach that location to then apply the catheter.
And the femoral artery being the artery at the front of your thigh?
Correct. It's the artery which is normally used for routine cardiac and kidney procedures in the cath lab every day.
And it may be a surprise to some people to hear that the kidney is important for controlling your blood pressure.
The kidney, in fact, is a major source of hormones that are released to cause blood pressure increases, and importantly, it's a central control system for the so-called sympathetic or autonomic nervous system that is involved in the generation of high blood pressure.
If somebody's got common or garden high blood pressure, and we'll come back to your study in a moment, is it the kidney that's going wrong?
That's a very important question. The kidney may be part of the original problem, but it's certainly part of the ongoing problem once that hypertension is established. The kidney is involved in, as I've said, hormone release and getting rid of salt and water, and it is these problems that contribute to the blood pressure. We can't say with certainty that all causes of garden variety hypertension come from the kidney originally, but it's certainly intimately related to its progression and persistence.
Now, I in my ignorance thought that those early operations in the 40s and 50s to cut the sympathetic nerves were to actually relax the blood vessels, stop the tension on the blood vessels, and therefore lower blood pressure that way, which is what you were describing. People couldn't stand up without fainting. I wasn't aware that the nerves going to the kidney had much influence on how these hormones, particularly the hormones that control salt, made a difference to that.
I think that is possibly the most exciting aspect of this, that there are local effects of disrupting these nerves, release of the hormones, getting rid of salt and water, effects on the tone in the vessels in the kidney, but there is also evidence that these nerves feed back to the brain controlling the release of traffic down the nerves. So, in fact, the whole body is potentially affected. And personally, I think that is why we're seeing the dramatic results that we showed in this proof of concept study.
Tell us about the people that you operated on.
These were patients who had so-called refractory hypertension, and that means they're on three or more agents to treat their blood pressure, one of which is a diuretic or agent that gets rid of salt and water. Despite that, had elevations of blood pressure, which were really quite dramatic, over 160 millimetres of mercury systolic.
That's the top figure. So despite maximal therapy, they were doing badly.
They were the worst of the worst hypertension patients, with obviously the greatest risk of downstream consequences such as stroke and heart attack, and that's really what we're trying to prevent here.
And this wasn't a control trial, this was a proof of principle.
All patients got the procedure. That was done for safety reasons and also to look for the effect first before we moved on to more controlled trials.
So what is the procedure?
The procedure involves cannulating the femoral artery, which is easily accessible in the groin, feeding a tube up into this main renal artery, which is adjacent to the nerves that run alongside of it, and applying what's called radio frequency signals, which again are commonly used in the treatment of various diseases in the heart, very low energy.
It generates heat.
It generates heat, and it generates it in a very localized area so that one can precisely pinpoint where one is actually directing that energy.
And it's through the artery wall you're doing it?
It's through the artery wall, and this heat energy will damage those nerves, and importantly, not cause damage to the lining of the renal artery, which obviously could cause downstream problems, in particular late narrowings, which is something we've looked very hard for.
And how do you know that the nerves are actually there? Because anatomy is variable between individuals, so sometimes it might go above, sometimes it might go below. How do you know where the nerves actually are if you're not actually looking at them?
Well, that's a very good question as well, and the short answer is we don't know exactly where the nerves are in each individual patient, but the technique takes into account the fact that the nerves are running somewhere along the artery, and the application of this energy is on a rotational basis. If you think of the artery walls as a clock face, 5 to 6 energies are applied at various points along the clock face on pulling back of the catheter so that we're pretty confident that there will be disruption of the nerves at some, if not all, of those energy applications.
And how often have you got to do this?
Both kidneys are denervated in the one sitting. There is evidence the nerves grow back. We know that from transplant studies. But we also know that they're not necessarily the nerves that actually regenerate the elevated blood pressures.
And so what were the results?
Well, the results were quite striking. What we found was a very marked reduction in blood pressure overall. We saw it early. We saw it persist, and if anything, it actually increased as patients went out to the 12 months, which is when the study ended.
Did it normalise?
Remember that these patients, their mean blood pressure was around 170, so it's a big ask to get patients to drop 40 millimetres of mercury to get to levels of, say, 130, but it dropped 27 millimetres of mercury overall. So that was a very dramatic result in these patients who, you'll recall, are very refractory by definition to standard agents.
And what about problems with low blood pressure, fainting when they stand up, perhaps even erectile dysfunction because of the sympathetic nerve problem?
We saw very few true symptomatic hypotension problems. We had 3 patients who we had to reduce their blood pressure medications because their blood pressures were getting on the low side. So we actually saw that as a good result. We've seen nothing in the way of impotence, those problems that plagued those early surgery studies. Some patients actually increased their medications, but very few of those were because they didn't respond, although it must be said we did have about 4 of the 45 patients who could be considered non-responders, so it didn't work in everyone.
And were there any effects on the stress hormones?
Yeah, importantly, we looked at a marker of sympathetic activity. In other words, were we achieving what we set out to do, which was to disrupt the nerves? And these nerves produce this hormone, noradrenaline, and using a technique pioneered by Murray Esler of the Baker, we were able to look specifically at that release within the kidney and found, in fact, a dramatic 45% reduction in release of that hormone. So to us, that was proof of concept that we actually were achieving denervation.
And complications like bleeding or disrupting the blood vessel?
We had one complication in a patient where there was damage to the arterial wall in introducing the catheter, but not actually with the radio frequency ablation itself. From patients who did get ablated, there were absolutely no consequences, no narrowings of the arteries, no thrombus formation, nothing.
How expensive is this procedure?
I have no idea what the cost.
Spoken like a true
be.
Researcher, Professor Crum.
I'm sure, and I should say that this is a commercial exercise. We were reached out to by an American startup biotechnology company who are seeing this as a commercial venture, but I have no idea what the eventual cost may be.
Next step is a proper randomised trial in a larger number of people. Henry Crum is Professor of Medicine and Director of the Centre for Cardiovascular Research and Education in Therapeutics at Monash University in Melbourne.
Craig McCarran, Somewhere Distant Place. Thank you.
sometimes I wander, drift away, disappear into another day. Catch a greyhound out of town, burn the place to the ground. One of these days I'm gonna catch a train, slip away, I'm gonna break the chain, go somewhere where they can't find me, catch no shoreline out to sea. Leave without a trace, somewhere distant place.
This is Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.